Welcome, everybody, to the Yanks Are Coming podcast. We're back after a summer break. My name is Carter Krishnire. He's Neil Blackman, and we're joined today by Nipun Chopra from Sock Takes and any number of other places, and we're going to discuss the elephant in the room. Let's just get right to it. The North American Soccer League's antitrust lawsuit against the United States Soccer Federation. Neil, you're our resident attorney. Let's turn it over to you for your interpretation of this filing. Obviously, the argument is that there are antitrust violations because of collusion in the marketplace between Major League Soccer and the United States Soccer Federation.
How the there's collusion in the marketplace, which has resulted in antitrust violations. And the argument is that U.S. Soccer has favored MLS, and that has damaged competition. What's interesting is that some of those favoritism arguments are sort of crafted in a way that suggests, you know, that marketplace. Well, I guess essentially, market. It's different than a pro rel argument, right? Like it's a marketplace favoritism argument, which, you know, it's weird. It's almost a dangerous argument to make because they could just say, well, if you're not favoring anything, then you don't need pro rel, or a court could come out sort of that way. So it's sort of it's a different take than what we've seen before, but not all that dissimilar from the sort of fundamental claims in the Frazier versus Major League Soccer opinion, which we've, you know, people have been down this road before. But I think that's where you can kind of turn it over to you, because the question becomes, you know, is NASL really the best vehicle for this sort of lawsuit? Or would it have been better for maybe USL, which is a league where the fundamentals are a bit stronger, to kind of make these marketplace favoritism arguments that might have some merit? But, you know, I mean, I can get into the ways that it's a little different than Frazier versus Major League Soccer, you know, in a little bit. If that's something to interest you guys, but I did want to kind of zero in on some of the things you wrote on World Soccer Talk about maybe how, you know, NASL has benefited from some favorable things that U.S. Soccer has done to help NASL stay in Division II status. So maybe we can kind of start there as a launching point. And there are obvious places where the laws can intersect with, you know, the entities involved.
Yeah, as you referenced, Neil, I wrote an article for World Soccer Talk that talks about the previous 7 years and that NASL has gotten cut one break after another by the U.S. Soccer Federation in terms of D2 sanctioning. They've been involved. They were involved in the crafting of these very D2 standards that they've fallen afoul of after 7 seasons, entering an 8th season, that they're now complaining about. And that my interpretation is that USL, who is the party that is in direct competition with NASL, although you may not know that necessarily from reading the full lawsuit, you might think it's Major League Soccer, but USL has not necessarily benefited from U.S. Soccer's alleged favoritism in this lawsuit. Now, when you're talking about Major League Soccer, that's a whole nother issue, and that's why, for some of us, the lawsuit is somewhat confusing, because I think there's clear favoritism. I think there's been a certain degree of collusion between U.S. Soccer and Major League Soccer. However, my points about NASL are that they have repeatedly failed to achieve the very standards, meet the very standards they helped craft for a Division II league, and that's they've been due to self-inflicted wounds. They've had nothing to do with the U.S. Soccer Federation or Major League Soccer, and very little to do with USL. So that's where my article, the basis of my article on World Soccer Talk, and Nipun, we're privileged to have you with us, because few, if anyone, in the U.S. soccer media has covered this subject as closely as you have over the course of the last 18 months, NASL sanctioning, NASL expansion, USL expansion, USL sanctioning. You've broken a couple big stories today, and maybe we can start there with what you're hearing from your sources within the NASL.
What I'm hearing, first of all, thank you guys for having me on. Karthik, you and I have done many, many, many podcasts together, and you'll have the pleasure chatting with you. I think with the NASL, the way things are right now, is that they're doing a good, relatively good job, at least compared to last year, of not leaking as much information as last year. I think last year they were hemorrhaging information, even though, you know, they claimed that it was a very well PR run league, which it's not. But having said that, it still is information coming out, and what we learned today, based on the lawsuit that you talked about in the article, Karthik, you had the first real analysis of the news, which is really good. After that, we learned this morning, actually last night, that the vote was not unanimous, and that this morning I had been given, I was able to corroborate that with multiple sources, that the vote was not unanimous. At the time, I didn't know with some certainty which teams did not vote for vote in approval of this litigation. My suspicions were North Carolina FC, Indy 11, and San Francisco Deltas. Subsequently, Neil Morris, who is arguably the best person covering the NASL USL in terms of his podcast, revealed that North Carolina, based on his sources, in fact did not were not in support of this litigation. I have been able to corroborate that Indy 11 was not in support of this litigation. I've also been able to corroborate, not from a primary source, but from multiple sources who would know, that Deltas are not in favor of this litigation. And I've been able to consistently source information that Edmonton are not in approval of this information. So that's four current clubs. Half of the current clubs, we're not talking about the expansions for next year, were not approving, or maybe a better way to put it, did not say yes. In their cases, it could have been backing out of the vote or saying no, but the fact of the matter is, at best...
And I should point out, Napoon, real quickly, in the case of North Carolina FC, per Neil Morris's reporting, North Carolina FC does not support the litigation. Not only did they not vote for it, now it's been filed and they do not support it. That's how I interpreted his article. Continue.
Yeah, no, that was kind of the end of what I was, information I have right now. In preparation for talking to you guys, I did go over the filing again for a third time, and I feel like every time I read this, I pick up on these little nuances which maybe I missed early on, and there's a lot of interesting information in here. And, you know, I'm glad that I'm able to talk to you guys. I think you've covered this stuff longer than anyone else I know, and Neil, of course, with your background as someone who understands this stuff way better than I do, I am, you know, the more I read it, I can't help but feel that what NASL has done is build some good inductive logic, but the problem seems to be the validity of some of the premises they are positing. For example, you know, the idea that the reason Rayo OKC died was because you know, NASL didn't get D1 status, which is demonstrably false. Or other ideas. But I'm curious, from your guys' perspective, like, how plausible does this even seem now?
Well, I thought, just from somebody with an antitrust background, I mean, and I have that, you know, I think there's the two most interesting things about it are, I think the most interesting argument is this argument that U.S. soccer doesn't really have any authority to govern professional soccer in this country, right? Like, that's a pretty fascinating take, which requires the challenge of FIFA, which to me is really interesting because it's almost the opposite of what Miami FC and Kingston Sake tried to do, right? Like, their argument was essentially that, hey, U.S. soccer does run the show and they're not complying with FIFA. This lawsuit essentially throws the baby and the bathwater out and says, well, there's this law called the Stevens Act, and that's a dubious law, and U.S. soccer doesn't have the authority to govern these things anyway. The second argument that, and, you know, interject if you think any of this is off or you're not really sure that what I'm talking about. But the second the second one that fascinated me was this argument that what U.S. soccer has done to sort of try to stabilize D2 is anti-competitive all of a sudden, right? And that's what I thought was resonated so well with Kardec's column, was like, look, U.S. soccer created this sort of weird year that we've just had to try to stabilize a second division. And now, because NASL ends up on the short end of it, suddenly those things are anti-competitive. And now, don't get me wrong, like, this is where Nipun would know way more than I would know. But, I mean, certainly the centralized structure of USL is problematic on that front, right? Because it prevents a merger, which probably would have stabilized everything for both sides, but, or at least gotten us closer to being stable. But I think that's a really fascinating argument, because this is not, like, NASL benefited from a lot of these moves that U.S. Soccer made. It's just that they lost, basically, in the marketplace, they were defeated. Largely because their business practices didn't work. So the merits of the lawsuit, are problematic, which kind of stinks, because Nipun's right. Like, at least one or two of the arguments they're making are rather innovative and sort of distinct from the pathway we've been down before, where there's binding precedent that's bad for them.
Yeah, I find the whole argument that U.S. soccer is not empowered to govern the sport in this country a little bit counterintuitive, considering there was that complaint filed that you mentioned at the CAS, the claim filed by Miami FC and Kingston Stockade, with Miami FC, of course, being an NASL member. But again, Miami FC probably is not the club, or the and Ricardo Silva is probably not the owner driving the train on this, Nipun. Is your sense, like mine, that a lot of this is coming from the frustrations of the new owner of the New York Cosmos, a guy who's owned the club for all of 8 months, Rocco Commisso?
I mean, I think it's pretty clear at this point, Karthik. I think we can say with some degree of confidence that he is the leader of this. How much Ricardo Silva is involved is debatable. I think if he wasn't involved, you would have heard from him. What I can say is, based on every single NASL post that passed here, they are being encouraged to not discuss this with the media. There's basically the American version of a gag order on communication with the media right now, and they're trying to make sure that whatever communication comes out comes from the NASL league office, which is why we don't know the reality of how supportive Ricardo Silva is of this. You talked about this on Reddit today, Karthik, and I can corroborate it, that Ricardo Silva, that we both have heard that Ricardo Silva has spoken with USL from my sourcing as recently as April of this year. I don't know if he's talked to them since, and I would like to think that based on the CAS filing, there's probably not more communication between NASL and Ricardo Silva, Miami FC, and USL. But who knows? You know, we don't know the answer to it. So it is a reasonable question to speculate how committed Ricardo Silva is to this particular filing that Robert Camiso is leading. But I'm a betting man, I would think that he is in support of it as well. Because ultimately, both of them want a way to get to D1. And let's not forget, not only is one of the requests of this lawsuit injunction stopping loss of D2, it's also removal of all USSF requirements and basically creating, basically a free-for-all market to decide what's D1, D2. So basically, actually, I shouldn't say that, not D1, D2, what works. But they want to get away from the phrasing of D1, D2 entirely. So that, right. I think, in essence, Ricardo Silva, in premise, would be in support of this, but I don't know from any sourcing whether he is.
Yeah, and in fact, I will acknowledged that that argument of taking away divisional designations was originated by a few people, including myself, and I've actually written about it several years ago at World Soccer Talk, and thought that it was a logical step forward to, at the time, in my thinking, to prevent USL from encroaching on NASL's territory. Now, because USL was building, wanting to regain second division status. Now, what in fact has happened is that USL has regained provisional second division status at the same time as the NASL has committed numerous self-inflicted wounds. It just repeated self-inflicted wounds that have nothing to do with the competition necessarily from USL or the alleged impropriety of Major League Soccer and the United States Soccer Federation. So I had actually, they may even reference my article in World Soccer Talk from 2014 or 2015, whenever it was written, about this idea if you're not having a pyramid where you have clear promotion and relegation and a clear first, second, third, and fourth division, that you have divisional designations taken off of leagues and you simply designate leagues as professional leagues or semi-professional leagues. And that means that the three professional leagues would be NASL, USL, and Major League Soccer. The non-professional leagues or the semi-pro leagues would be organized through the United States Adult Soccer Association, USASA, and they would be given the ability, and they are a member, obviously, of U.S. Soccer, of the United States Soccer Federation, to they would be given the jurisdiction to designate those leagues, those semi-professional leagues. That was my proposal a few years ago. But again, I mean, I think there are a lot of original arguments the NASL is making, as you said, Neil. I think that there are a number of things in this lawsuit that are compelling. But again, it's difficult to, and I don't know how a court views this, and maybe you can address this, Neil. It's difficult to take seriously a plaintiff, someone who has filed this claim, who is saying that because of the unfair trade practices of Major League Soccer and the U.S. Soccer Federation, the monopolistic practices, that teams such as Rio OKC failed. Fort Lauderdale is in the complaint. There's also a discussion of some of these other issues, financial issues that teams have had. When each and every one of those cases were self-inflicted NASL wounds, which I think U.S. Soccer's defense attorneys can very clearly point out. How does that affect a judge?
Well, look, I think, I think there's two. I've read it one and a half times, okay? So that's my disclaimer. But the word conspiracy, I think, is in the complaint at least 25 times. It might be more than that. I stopped counting. So they kind of have to win their conspiracy arguments or collusion arguments that for whatever reason, MLS was horrified of NASL. Like, the fundamental argument that NASL makes in these conspiracy arguments is, hey, we were ready to go to D1 already, and U.S. Soccer was in our way, right? I don't know. This is where I think just there will be a significant fact problem. Like, and this is why I keep coming back to your excellent article, I think, is because they didn't try to penetrate markets that Garber encircled or that, you know, quite frankly, USL accessed. The only market that I can think of where, you know, NASL did a good job was Miami, and they were reluctant to access that market and largely abandoned Fort Lauderdale in their hour of need. Whether that was because they needed to distance themselves from traffic, or they actually believed the Brazilian investors that came in, or for whatever reason, it didn't really work. And, you know, it's not like MLS was ignoring Miami. It's just that we all, you and I both know what a fiasco that is politically, but that's a whole other show. So I think that's kind of an area where it's problematic for them to sort of win those arguments. And then I think secondarily, what's interesting and that what a judge will certainly evaluate is, you know, if their goal with the permanent injunction against divisional sanction is, hey, cons- consumers will sort it out and they'll decide what they prefer. Like, for every person like me or you that's upset that NESL didn't work in South Florida just because we wanted a pro soccer club, right? Like, consumers sort of have decided. I mean, that would be US soccer's argument. Like, consumers have decided. They've decided that your league isn't what they want to watch, that they'd prefer to watch Major League Soccer, and that they'd prefer to watch USL, and that's fine. Like,
because
that's what
I'll point this out. NASL, early on, made the argument that they had none of the restrictions, structural restrictions that Major League Soccer or USL have on their clubs. They have none of those things that would prevent clubs from competing in the open market and signing whatever player in theory they want and doing whatever they want to market wherever they want. And clearly, that didn't work. And so, and at the time, the thinking internally at NASL, and I was at NASL at the time, so I can speak to this, was, look, no one knows these divisional designations, D1, D2, D3. No one acknowledges them. It's only soccer geeks and people in the legal department at the U.S. Soccer Federation that actually know about these divisional designations. We have a team in Atlanta. We're the first division in Atlanta. We have a team in Fort Lauderdale. We're the first division in South Florida. We have a team in Tampa Bay, another huge market, former MLS market. We're first division there. And yet, for some reason, after we had thought along those lines for a number of years, it became a situation where the New York Cosmos came into the league and then started complaining about not being Division One and saying that they couldn't attract sponsors and players and all of these things because they weren't designated as a first division. Now, quite frankly, and now maybe soccer is more in the mainstream now, but quite frankly, if you go back about 12 years, there was confusion, unless you were a diehard soccer fan, as to whether Major League Soccer, they had the name Major League Soccer, whether they were the first division or USL's first division. USL called their top league the USL First Division, was actually the first division because they had Montreal, Vancouver, Seattle, Portland, Rochester. They had about half or more than half of the kind of big clubs in the country at the time. So there's been confusion in the marketplace about these divisional designations. I think what you have now is a situation where Major League Soccer is a clear, established market leader. Now, did they achieve that market leadership because of the unfair trade practices that are alleged towards the U.S. Soccer Federation? NASL will have to try and prove that. But if you take the divisional designations off these leagues now, my belief is it doesn't help NASL at all. They have a failing business. They have a failing business model. And they will be competing then head-to-head with MLS, who is an established market leader who may just choose to crush them within the season. So I'm not quite sure what the end game here is for NASL, which is a question for you, Nipun. What is the long-term vision and strategy for this league, given they've now embarked on this radical new course, for lack of a better word?
So first of all, to answer your question, Neil, the word conspiracy is cited 33 times in that article. And that doesn't even account for words like conspiratorial or anything like that. Just the word conspiracy is 33 times. So, yeah,
thank you.
Now, to answer your question, Karthik, I don't think there's a vision. I mean, this is a conversation we go back to every year. What is NASL's vision? What is NASL's vision? And at the beginning of every season, we're told the same thing, which is that this year, the NASL owners are united, and this year, there's a vision. At the start of this year, being 2017, we were told that the vision was collaboration and working together to promote soccer all over the country, et cetera, et cetera. Well, 3 months later, Neil Morris interviewed Camiso, and it was pretty clear that that was not the case in terms of collaborating for the league. And now they're basically suing each other.
And his Tom Payne interview, where it was very clear around the same time. Remember, Neil interviewed Tom Payne from Puerto Rico FC, and it was pretty clear he had disdain for one or two owners in the boardroom.
Absolutely. And I would, in Tom Payne's defense, for good reason, apparently, so what happened.
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't know. There's no vision, Karthik. Right now, the vision is survival, as was the case at this time last year. when they were just trying to make sure that they survived. And I was repeatedly told last year that that they felt that as long as we get to 2018, we'll be fine. As long as we get to 2018, we'll be fine, which was this magical number. Well, I don't know if we will get to 2018, you know, the way things are now. And even if the league gets to 2018, the same things are going to repeat. I mean, Rocco Commisso's litigation is not going to go away. The cash filing is not going to go away. So they're basically back to this abrasiveness in these soccer wars, for, you know, lack of a phrase, a book that you wrote, Karthik, that I recommend every U.S. soccer fan to read. I don't see any vision outside of survival right now. I mean, that's really the only thing that's
Right, and this is a point I tried to make, Napoon, is that you keep hearing a lot of NASL's proponents say, well, they're going to add New Orleans, they're going to add Orange County, they're going to add Atlanta, they're going to add this one, they're going to add that one. But the track record of recent franchises that have entered, and they are franchises, okay, there's this NASL rhetoric, which is, oh, we actually have clubs, and the teams in MLS and USL are franchises. Well, actually, many of the teams in USL and MLS are more clubs than yours, because they have a women's team, and they have a youth setup, and they have a reserve team, and all of the things that are entailed in soccer clubs, whereas most of the MLS team, NASL teams are just franchises. But that's me on my soapbox for a minute. But there is this feeling, I think, that all these new teams could come in. But as I point out in my article, four of the last five NASL startups have had significant problems and have either gone out of business or have barely limped by or the league has had to assume control. And the one exception is Miami FC, who then someone in the comments right away said, well, yeah, Miami FC's been fine, but as Neil referenced a little earlier, that helped kill off Fort Lauderdale, so basically five out of five have been problems, if you look at it that way, and that's true. So I think that there is... NASL's out of chances.
Let me ask you guys a question. Yeah, let me ask you a question, because you brought up something interesting, Karthik, about the survival portion of it and the expansion portion of it. Like, you just talked about New Orleans and Atlanta and Detroit were the three teams that were named in the middle section of this litigation. Basically, hang on, I'll tell you the exact phrasing as I look it up. So it says in point number 184, specifically the NASL represented in its 2018 sanctioned submission letter to the USSF that an ownership group in New Orleans had entered into a letter of intent to bring a new club to NASL, and the league was also in discussions with ownership groups in Detroit and Atlanta, blah, 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 blah. Okay, so those three teams have been named as basically teams that were on board. Now, instead of sticking this in your stupid-ass lawsuit, why didn't they announce those three teams? Because New Orleans would be the central time zone team. And with those three teams, they would be well above 12. They'll be at 13. Why not announce those teams? And then if USSF says, hey, we're demoting you to D2, that is and I'm not a lawyer, but based on logic, that is a clearly winnable lawsuit. Because if you get demoted at that point where you have the requisite number of teams, where you have the number of central time zone, essentially, you have zero waivers. That's the key point. You have zero waivers at that point. Then if you're demoted, you win that lawsuit, in my opinion. So why didn't they do that? It makes no sense to me.
Yeah, I mean, I can't answer that question.
Answer that, right. That's a question that's come up. You mentioned the excellent Neil Morris. He and I had a private conversation about the thinking that we have now, which is, and it might be reflected in his reporting, that the NASL obviously must have foregone taking that appeal period after losing the D2 sanctioning, the 30 days or 2 weeks, whatever they had. It was reported in some areas as 30 days until October 1st. Some people reported that it was 2 weeks. Whatever it was, they could have submitted a new application with those three teams you mentioned. And so what Neil Morris and I believe from talking to one another is that it probably means that they have foregone another proposal for Division II, and they've just decided to burn down the house and file a lawsuit.
right, it's just, I mean, it's kind of ridiculous to me. I spoke to Neil in a private conversation too. I never believed that they had a chance to come back with this, and that's what this suggests. Which one of their points, against 180, I think 187 it was, where they talked about how the league didn't give them a month's time to fix up. Here it is. Tellingly, the USSF treated the USL's Division II application completely different from the NASL's application. The USSF provisionally waived many requirements for USL and simply required it to provide a, quote, plan for bringing its teams into compliance, end quote, with the Division II requirements within approximately a month's time, unlike the NASL, whose Division II application the USSF flatly denied. So I think from the get-go, I was surprised when we heard about this 2 weeks, 1 month stuff for NASL. For me, it was a done deal. But what blows me away is that if truly these three teams were on board, if truly Atlanta, New Orleans, and Detroit were on board, and you didn't announce them because you were twiddling your thumbs or because you felt... So there are only two explanations for me with this. One explanation is that NASL is incredibly incompetent, which is completely possible. The other one is that these three teams were not ready to go in time, and that they're basically representing this blatant lie in their lawsuit. Because those teams were ready to go, there's no reasonable sense why the NASL doesn't announce those teams and basically meet all of USSF's requirements. It's absurd to me.
Yeah. Absolutely. That's why I think some of us, after we read that part, were at such a loss to explain this. And the only explanation we have is that they're now being used in the lawsuit, but they weren't ready to go. I'm under the impression Detroit City wants to see some stability in the NASL before they sign on. Now, I can't speak to Atlanta and New Orleans. I haven't spoken to anyone at those clubs. You may have. But my impression from my sources around Detroit was that they have had serious negotiations with the NASL, but they're concerned about the instability of the league, which goes back, as I mentioned in my article, it goes back to the whole San Francisco issue. I think that was the last straw, particularly considering a year ago when NASL was in the same position and Tampa Bay and Ottawa, two of the four most stable clubs in the league. I would say there were really only four stable clubs in NASL, and those four stable clubs were Indy, North Carolina, Ottawa, and Tampa Bay. Two of those clubs say, you know what, we're tired of this, we're leaving, for whatever reasons that they left. They left. They went to USL. They went directly to the rival league. A year after San Antonio, the only club in the league that had actually built its own soccer-specific stadium, bailed, and in a complicated legal maneuver, moved to USL with a different name and different ownership, but essentially the same club. So what we were being told at the time was, well, just you wait. We have a superstar club, and the way they built up... And I was telling someone this the other day, the way they built up San Francisco was the same way we, and I say we because I worked at the league at the time and I was the director of communications, the way we built up San Antonio going into the 2012 season, knowing it was going to be a home run, knowing we were going to get 7,000 or 8,000 people a game, realizing they might have a chance to actually have enough political support and money locally to build their own stadium, which they did. They were the only NASL team to date that has built its own soccer-specific stadium. So San Francisco was built up very much the same way, guys. And I think U.S. Soccer even bought into some of that rhetoric. And many in the media, ourselves included, bought into that. And San Francisco is the biggest dud.
I am 100% guilty of this. 100% guilty.
Yeah, I was too. Because I saw the pattern the same way that we had built up San Antonio. They were building up San Francisco. So I thought, okay, this is the new San Antonio Scorpions. This is the new superstar team in the league. For all the talk of the Cosmos, etc. We've had San Antonio, we've had Indy, and now we're going to have San Francisco.
Sure.
These are the star teams.
Right, and you had to think, you saw Sacramento Republic too.
Right, right.
And you thought, how could this go wrong?
Yeah.
And so, you know, yeah, as to Atlanta, I can tell you that their two fundamental concerns there were stadium and location of said stadium. So where they were going to play was everything. Because if they were outside the perimeter, if you know anything about Atlanta, then they pretty much had would damn themselves to ruin. But there were enough people who were soccer mad in that city that were like, well, yeah, we would go to both.
Until about 6 weeks ago, I was hearing from Atlanta personnel, I'd say, twice a week on average. In the last 6 weeks, I have sent messages, emails, Twitter messages. I have heard absolutely nothing from Atlanta, and I think it's indicative of that things aren't all great over there. So in terms of Detroit, from my understanding, there's still an issue with the principal owner, which would mean that they wouldn't qualify for D2 requirements. And in terms of New Orleans, I really have no idea. I think the person who knows the answer to that is Chris Kivlan from Victor Press. I have no idea what's going on there.
Right.
Yeah, I think New Orleans is an interesting change, though, for NASL potentially, because it would be the first market they've entered into in a while that, well, other than Jacksonville, that does not meet the D1 requirement, the proposed D1 requirement of 2 million metro area for a D1 team. So that's actually maybe a bit of a refreshing change that they're going after a legitimate D2 market. But go on.
Yeah. I mean, that might be something we want to isolate too and talk about real quick is D1 requirements, because I think, like, when I look at this complaint, I say the best portions of this complaint are the anti-competitive arguments about Division I status. And like, I've heard the argument that, you know, maybe some of these regulations are actually pro-competitive because they assure that clubs that couldn't punch their way don't go out of business, right? And I guess, you know, from a purely market theoretical standpoint, that's probably true. But it's interesting. When a lot of these USL owners that broke had a hand in crafting some of these standards, right, in 2010, I think. So it becomes, you know, interesting that now the ones that are left are saying, hey, these standards are bad. The 2 million, for example, there's only 30 cities that would ever meet that requirement. But I think that one's less market problematic because you could get a waiver, and that's right. A pretty easy argument for U.S. soccer to make compared to, say, you know, the ownership arguments where you have to have either, what is it, 70 million? Or a single owner with 40 million?
Yes.
And I think it's not or either, it's and, right? Like, there has to be a majority owner who has a $40 million net worth and an ownership group value of 70 million. So the Green Bay Packers, for example, would not be able to play in MLS.
Correct.
But you know, and maybe they would. Maybe they somehow would. I'm sure
they'd get a waiver.
Meet the second requirement.
Right.
They would meet the second requirement, and maybe there's. I'm sure there's an investor, a majority investor in the Green Bay Packers that's worth more than $40 million, and so you access it that way. But these are the kinds of standards that are bad, right? And so that's an interesting aspect to challenge. But that gets back into what is the goal of the. The lawsuit, and this was the most confusing thing to me, is that if you're seeking a permanent injunction against divisional sanction, then what's the pathway to pro rel, which a month and a half ago, pro rel was your, you know, Ark of the Covenant. It was, hey, we're going to go to Switzerland and we're going to litigate this out. So now you... And maybe that's the perfect metaphor for the dysfunction of the NASL, right?
Right.
Is that Rocco in the cosmos, Rocco in the cosmos vision is, hey man, if it weren't for U.S. soccer, we would be D1. And also divisional sanctioning is stupid because we're not D1. Whereas, like, Miami SC is sort of like, hey, we're making a lot of money down in here. And, you know, or we're willing to lose a lot of money, either way you want to look at it. And we think we should have pro rel because our team is pretty good. And, like, if you saw the Galaxy play in Atlanta tonight, you can't tell me we wouldn't work them all over the field most nights. So, I don't know. I mean, I just, you know, I hate to be snarky about it, but to some extent, it is kind of the perfect metaphor for the dysfunction of the NASL, that within 2 months you have lawsuits that are functionally inopposite.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, and are irreconcilable. I was just going to say that they're irreconcilable in terms of their outcomes. Right? I mean, if this lawsuit that's been filed in U.S. court, if this is successful, then the NASL is essentially blown up, or the court system will blow up the structure, which would make what Miami FC and their partner, Kinston Stockade, but Miami FC being the important party here in NASL, a member of the NASL LLC, what they're trying to put in place through that CAS complaint, impossible to achieve.
Sure.
No, I agree, but I will say this. I think it's important for us to recognize that the ProRel filing is not an NASL-sponsored filing, although we all know.
Right. That's very true. In fact,
that is fair.
I should point out the league went to great pains the morning. It's funny because I haven't heard from the league or anyone in the league since this, but the league went to great pains the morning that that CAS claim was filed, Napoon, and they probably did the same thing with you, to reach out to me and tell me very matter-of-factly, this is not a league initiative. It is a single team in our league, acting independently, because we're an independent league. We have independent clubs, all that jazz that they love to hang their hat on. So, yes, that is correct, Napoon. You're right, and we should remember that.
Yeah, and to be fair, like I'm not arguing against your point, Neil, because everyone knows that all the NASL was, all the teams were in support of that, because ultimately all of them want, most of them want ProRel and want to have the ability to be D1. But it is a pedantic distinction. Speaking of the pedantic distinction, I mean, I think that everything I've talked to people on Twitter and Reddit and surprisingly in real life too, about this filing, it seems to me that there seems to be this idea that, let me put it this way. If we start with the premise that MLS, USL, and USSF are in cahoots, I think this case makes a lot of sense from that lens. But if you take a step back, if you come in from fresh eyes and say, I'm going to go in objectively, you can dismiss everything in this case as conjecture and circumstance and like coincidence. So, for example, you know, you were talking about the change, the sliding scale, the increasing scale of requirements for D1, which is an absolutely fair point. It changed so much from 95, 96, as you pointed out, the principal owner and all that stuff has changed so much. But all MLS has to do is, we were just trying to say that we were simply trying to increase the requirements to increase the valuation of our teams. So if you come in from the lens of, you know, this is from an objective lens and not with the preconceived bias that USSF, MLS, USL are in cahoots, all of this can be basically goes away immediately. And I would encourage people who are reading this to try to read it from the perspective of someone is coming in without knowledge of USS, of all this drama, because for the most part, a judge is not going to be masturbating Ted Westerveld. He's going to have no idea what's going on with any of this. So they're going to come in from an objective set of eyes. So to understand whatever decision a judge makes, I think you have to come in from the perspective that of getting rid of all these preconceived biases.
Yeah, that's something I wanted to ask both of you guys about, was that I think there was a lot of conjecture. That's why I likened it to the conspiracy theories we see on Reddit, because there was a lot of assumptions made about conspiracies, and this one is linked to this one, therefore this other one is benefiting from the linkage between this one and that one. Party A and B have a relationship, party A and C have a relationship, therefore B and C must have a relationship. I can tell you from just following various aspects of business, that's not true. I'll give you this one example. The One World Alliance, if you fly American Airlines or British Airways, I fly British Airways a lot. American Airlines and British Airways have a joint venture. American Airlines has a joint venture with Qantas Airways, which is an Australian airline. Qantas used to have a joint venture with British Airways, but it broke down in acrimony, and they now are alliance partners with Emirates, who is a airline that American Airlines, who is their other joint venture partner, has filed a complaint with the U.S. Department of Transportation against. And British Airways, who is the other joint venture partner, has no relationship with Emirates or Qantas. So, these are the sorts of things just in business. That was the first example that came to mind. But you cannot make some of the leaps of faith and the assumptions they made, which to me, once again, read like what you see on Reddit. And I think there is a clear case to be made, and I think, Neil, you're right, that the strongest point of it is the D1 arbitrary standards and Major League Soccer having a business relationship with the U.S. Soccer Federation that may prejudice the governing body toward them. However, once again, I have to point out that this has been filed after NASL has been denied D2 sanctioning, and their competition is USL, and maybe your reporting is a little different than this, Nipun. I found absolutely no evidence, except for that one passage that NASL put in there about USL being given 30 days to fix their application, which was not accepted by U.S. Soccer, was essentially tabled until the next board meeting, whereas NASL's was rejected. I see no other evidence, and based on my reporting, actually, it might be to the contrary, no other evidence that USL, who's the party that NASL is competing with at this point, has gotten favorable treatment from U.S. Soccer just because.
Right.
So that's, to me, the big problem with the whole thing.
I totally agree. It's that same passageway also says that USL seems to have been granted 20 waivers. It's unclear to me, and I tried to figure this out with Neil on Neil Morris on Twitter, whether that means that they're being awarded 20 waivers for next year, or they were told 20 waivers that you need to fix in this 1 month, or what is exactly what that means. Because the phrasing in that, and Neil, you're better to interpret this than I can, but the way it seems to me is that the argument being made suggests that USL is going to get 20 waivers for next year as well. And if that is true, I think, again, that is some credence to the idea that there is imbalance between the valuation of waivers for NASL and valuation for waivers for USL.
From a technical standpoint, because it's just a complaint, you know, there are going to be some things that are a little less clear. And then potentially, you know, you deal with dismissal and then maybe a second complaint where they kind of clarify what that legal language means. So I think, because I'm reading it, and it's... Yeah, I mean, it's subject to, I think, multiple interpretations. And, you know, I would just say at this point, essentially, their USL argument is like USL sides have some affiliations with MLS, and they might be getting some waivers. So, U.S. Soccer likes them more, and that might be enough at the complaint stage, right?
and I mean, you summarized it really well. Ultimately, all that, even if what I was saying was true, ultimately it would just show that there was some positive bias from USSF towards USL in this one particular situation. It cannot be extrapolated to this huge conspiracy that involves MLS and USSF and USL trying to put NASL out of business. Because even if what I was saying was true, it could simply be because USSF just got tired of NASL asking for waivers. I mean, that it's as simple as that. So the devil in the details.
Right. Yeah. So, Dabuna, that's such an important point. I want to repeat that. NASL has been getting waiver after waiver after waiver for 7 years. The USL, when it appeared...
Antarctic, not according to NASL Rising.
Right. which, by the way, is a play on USL Rising, their motto, their slogan. But the point being that USL dropped down to Division III status in 2010 and 2011 because they could not meet the D2 standards, and they were feeling quite honestly, remembering that period and being on the NASL side of it, but understanding, having friends on the other side I was talking to, they were aggrieved, and I have to be honest, we were kind of concerned USL might file a lawsuit against us and the U.S. Soccer Federation. They did not. They just took their medicine, went down to D3, regrouped, consolidated, and they're back in a strong position. I think what NASL is doing is selectively, as you said, Nipun, they're talking about this specific filing, but the two things that are important is I think U.S. Soccer got tired of giving NASL waiver after waiver after waiver, year after year. Standards the NASL had helped craft, which said they would be at a certain point after 3 years. They didn't meet that target. They would be at a certain point after 5 years. After 7 years, they still haven't met those five-year targets, and they've kept letting them slide on it. And then you add in the San Francisco situation. I think they just got tired of it, to be honest with you. Now, there are things in the complaint that, as you mentioned, Neil, that are I think, very legally sound and could give NASL an opportunity in the court of law to get some sort of relief from the courts. But I still believe, and I'm going to go on the record and say this again, that U.S. Soccer, who I am very critical of normally, everybody knows that, acted properly in rejecting the NASL's application for D2 status for 2018. I'm stunned that actually Sunil Gulati and U.S. Soccer were so decisive, because part of the reason I've been so critical of U.S. Soccer is they haven't shown leadership, they haven't been decisive, they've made countless mistakes in how they govern the pro leagues, and that was one of the first times I looked up and said, you know what, Sunil's showing some pretty amazing leadership. And
sure. Yeah, go ahead. I couldn't agree more. And I think that's what's so interesting about this complaint. To me, strikes me as like a lot of, and this is a strategy that really talented lawyers use, right? Like sometimes you plead as many things as you can in a complaint, and you just kind of see what gets whittled away.
Yeah, what sticks.
And then there's a secondary kind of a complaint that can follow it, where you now have isolated your more meritorious arguments, I guess. And I think that might be it. I mean, maybe that's what they have to do, like just sort of narrow it down to a sanctioning lawsuit, because these conspiracy arguments, not only are they hurt on fact issues, right? I mean,
right.
In an antitrust lawsuit, you have to win that there's some sort of exclusive territory that is controlled by the primary defendant. In this case, the U.S. Soccer Federation. Okay, what's the market? What market is alleged? Is it soccer in the United States? Because in that case, guess what? U.S. Soccer has a lot of competitors. Look at the HEC standings.
Right.
Watch what was on TV today. There's a lot of competition, whether it's from the Mexican League.
Yeah, it's the League Cup, it's La Liga, Real Madrid, right. And so U.S. Soccer could argue that they are...
U.S. Soccer, I mean, they really might... No, and not only could U.S. Soccer argue that, like, I could see, because Nipun made the really astute point that the judges are going to have these preconceived biases, right? So if he sits back or she sits back and sort of evaluates this, they might lose on market. Like,
right.
A judge might go, U.S. Soccer doesn't control this market. Bye. Your business model failed. Sorry.
Right. Yeah.
It's called capitalism.
Man. That is scary.
Right. It depends on the perspective of the judge. If they take a very narrow interpretation of soccer in the United States being all of the clubs that are organized under the U.S. soccer umbrella, or if they look at the macro, what's on television, what if they look at other sports and entertainment that's competing with U.S. soccer, and U.S. soccer is just one entity competing not only with the Premier League and La Liga and everything, and Liga MX on television, but also with the NFL and the NBA and various movies and television programs.
I think where they filed it, also, their market arguments are more problematic for them. Okay, and what I mean by that is if you go to Indianapolis and file that sucker in the seventh, all right, you're going to deal with a lot of judges that are appointed that might see those markets a lot more narrowly. Okay, but, you know, you get a judge that does take a more macro view and says, hey, here in New York City, these are all the different places. I can walk down Amsterdam Avenue and get a good idea of the market for soccer in the United States. And let me tell you what it isn't controlled by, Soccer House. Right? So, I don't know. I mean, I think there's a lot of sort of, it's almost like the early rounds of a boxing match back before that sport was entirely corrupted. Sorry, I'm still a little bitter about Saturday, but the feeling out process, this complaint strikes me as that. It strikes me as like, if their lawyers are as talented as I think they are, you know, they're just trying to access what their best arguments are, and then maybe by the time they file an amended complaint, it looks a little different. Stay tuned would be my lawyer message.
Napoon, final thoughts.
Yeah. Final thought, news is leaking regularly. I think there'll be more news in the next upcoming days. I think stay tuned is probably the best final thought there is.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think what we're bringing you is the best podcast we can for this week, but by next Monday, this could be a heated conversation. So stay tuned, everyone. That's the best advice. Thank you, Napoon, for joining us.
Thank you, Napoon. Thank you so much.
And Napoon, where can we find your work online?
Absolute pleasure talking to you guys anytime. You can find my work on Soft Takes. That's Soft Takes on Twitter. We are trying to... our business model is that we always pay our contributors because we feel like good quality content is pretty lacking sometimes in lower league soccer. So we want to make sure that people who contribute for us are remunerated for that content. And for that, we have a Patreon. So if you're interested in supporting lower league soccer coverage, subscribe to or become a patron for Soft Takes, and we'd really appreciate it.
And where can they do that, just so everybody knows?
Yeah, so if you go to SoftTakes' website, I actually have to pull up the Patreon page, but I think it's softtakes.com/Patreon. But if you go to softtakes.com website, I think on the front page itself, there's a link to the Patreon page.
There's a link. Beautiful.
Fantastic.
And how do people follow you on Twitter?
You can follow me at NapoonChopper7, but I don't think I provide too much information that someone like Karthik and Neil would not provide you. So if you want to come for the hot takes, you can stop by. You'll find me talking about Man United or talking about neuroscience. So I'm kind of one of many good followers on Twitter.
Yes, I would concur with that. Definitely follow Napoon if you want lower league information.
Absolutely.
And Manchester United fans being called out by another Manchester United fan. Like me with Manchester City fans calling out Manchester City fans. Eerily similar. So
Napoon, one last question before we wrap this up. Does the U.S. qualify for the World Cup?
Oof, loaded question.
I think so, yes.
In a playoff?
In a playoff. That's what I was going to add. I think it would be in a playoff. Yeah. What do you guys think?
I love it. Stay tuned, Napoon.
Yeah, we'll have our predictions before the Panama game. But I think you are probably on the right track of what I'm thinking.
You hit that one down the fairway.
Can't wait to find out. Thank you guys so much for having me on. Genuine pleasure.
And thank you. And once again for Neil, I'm Karthik. We will catch you next week. We'll be back with you regularly, weekly. Through the fall and through this U.S. qualifying, this excruciating U.S. qualifying run, including potentially an intercontinental playoff. Stay tuned. A reminder that you can follow us on Twitter at yanksarecoming.com. You can subscribe to us on iTunes or other podcast mechanisms. And you can follow Neil at NW Blackman on Twitter, and I'm at KKFLA737. So until next time.